Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your duck walk and duck face of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. Johnny B. Good, that's true, but Johnny B. Redundant. So you are not going to hear Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Good at the beginning of this very special tribute episode to Chuck Berry, who died late last week at 90 years old. We've just opened up with Maybelline, which is the first Chuck Berry single, which went to number 5 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart in 1955, which is many years before I was born, to be totally frank.
A couple of weeks.
To celebrate the life of Chuck Berry, I am joined by chief pop music critic, John Perellis.
Hey there.
We both wrote pieces about Chuck Berry in the past few days. Chuck Berry did not lead an uncomplicated life or career. There were a lot of pockmarks and road bumps along the way. So before we get to some of the modeled parts of the career, let's talk about the first 4 or 5 years. Because you can say, almost, I think, without argument, that the Chuck Berry run from 1955 to 1961 is not just the foundation of what we came to think about rock and roll, but really is a foundation for kind of all of modern pop, if you really are going to extrapolate it out.
All of the fun stuff about American popular music right there.
That sound didn't come out of nowhere. So let's talk about where the Chuck Berry idea came from, because he draws on a bunch of stuff. He's drawing on blues, he's drawing on country. Talk to us a little bit about what Chuck Berry did in his synthesis that was so unique.
Well, start with Maybelline. Maybelline's a country song, Ida Red,
yeah,
that he changed the beat, changed the tone, changed the lyric, but it's still, there's bluegrass in there.
Yeah.
The thing about Chuck Berry is he was from St. Louis. He wasn't from the Deep South. He wasn't from Bluesland, Chicago. He was from Middle America. And so he was pulling together country and blues and pop. And he was an older guy. He was not some young whippersnapper. He was in his 30s when he did this.
You point that out. I mean, he was 30 in 1955 or right around there.
Yeah, so 1926.
So there was, he wasn't like a whippersnapper who was just sort of like doing the latest craze.
But he was thinking about it, though. I mean, he was thinking, what would teenagers like? And teenagers were kind of a new thing in the 50s. Mm-hmm. The post-war economy mm-hmm. created the American teenager. They needed a new outlet for consumption.
Can you talk about that? Because I feel like that's an important thing that came up in your piece about this sort of inventing not just the idea of the teenager, but also the soundtrack for that idea. What was so specific about what was happening in the mid-1950s where teenaging became its own standalone thing? And why did it become a thing, and why did it need a soundtrack?
Well, it became a thing because of the baby boom, obviously. There were babies after World War II who were in the 50s turning into teenagers.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So you had this bumper crop, this demographic wave, and they needed something to do and something to listen to, and you could sell them stuff. There was also the post-war, let's put America back to work. It was an affluent time.
Yeah.
And there was leisure time for cars and girls, mm-hmm. which is basically what Chuck Berry, his genius, calculated and sang about.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's going to care about cars and girls.
And he seemed to love them both. I don't want to say equally, but he loved them both very strongly.
He loved them both. But he also very much loved rock and roll. I mean, you have blues about the blues. I mean, I guess you have jazz songs about swing, but he really had lots of songs about rock and roll.
And rock and roll, it's important to note, was an idea before Chuck Berry. It was like an abstract idea, but Chuck Berry was really the person who codified the set of influences.
Absolutely.
And the set of exports that we come to think of now. And when I think of pre-rock and roll or pre-Chuck Berry, you think about country music being
regionally
specific and demographically specific. You have blues and jump blues. You have jazz, which is like moving in maybe a hotter direction. Chuck Berry is really the first guy to stitch that all into one thing.
There was plenty of precedent. I mean, Louis Jordan,
yep.
That whole jump blues thing, mm-hmm. were the hyperactive front man and some really nice double entendres and a great backbeat. That was there for him. For him to put some country twang in there and for him to put T-Bone Walker's guitar in there.
Which was the essential thing, yeah.
I mean, it's alchemy. And, you know, we look at it now and it's so familiar. You have to remember somebody had to come up with it. And that's the amazing radical thing. He made this synthesis that in retrospect seems absolutely natural. And somebody had to come up with it, and he was the guy who did.
Do you think at that time, I mean, we're still in segregated America, we're pre-civil rights. Do you think at that time it was common for musicians to be engaged with sort of both sides, to be playing in traditionally black idioms and also in white idioms that, of course, when you dig back, were black idioms, but it had been moved in a different direction? How common was that in the 50s?
I would think it was more common than we think because entertainers like to entertain. Musicians like to steal.
Yeah.
And so if your audience is listening to those songs on the radio, why not put your own spin on them? Why not do a country song with a blues backbeat? And this was happening in clubs. This wasn't happening on records. This wasn't happening on the radio. This was happening nightly before a specific audience. It wasn't something the record companies were figuring out needed to be documented.
And so Chuck Berry's first single did very, very well. Was that typical of the time where people could just sort of emerge roughly out of nowhere and kind of have these smash hits?
There was less. I mean, there was no
SoundCloud.
yeah. It was pre-SoundCloud. There wasn't a whole lot of music out there.
Right.
But also, I think one key to Chuck Berry is he didn't sound like a Southern black man. He just sounded like a Midwestern American. He had very clear enunciation. There was no particular regionalism in his voice.
So part
you could
of the
hear
way,
every word.
So part of the way that he was able to sort of like be diffused so quickly throughout pop was that there were probably people who didn't actually know.
Yeah, some promoters thought he was white.
Yeah.
In the early days. And it's horrible. But, you know, radio made listeners more colorblind. And it's horrible that that has to be the way it happens. But that's part of how Chuck Berry made his crossover. And more power to him. The thing that comes through those early records is they're calculated because he's thinking about what are the people going to want to hear. But they're also crazy. They're also wild. There's a recklessness in them that you still hear now, even though you've heard the Chuck Berry lick, you know, for a lifetime. I want you guys to listen to Beautiful Delilah, which is one of his 50s singles. And you tell me how many keys this song is in at the same time.
All right, we're going to listen to that right now. Beautiful Delilah.
Always gets a second look from fellows passing by. Every time you see her, she's with a different guy. Beautiful Delilah, that's the reason why Rebecca don't allow me to fool around with you. You are so tantalizing, you just can't be true.
So I hope everybody has their notepads and they were taking notes because a lot's going on in Beautiful Delilah.
Skips beats. The piano seems to be playing in a whole different key. I don't know what's going on. It's wonderful.
And these are all records that his 50s outputs on Chess, right?
Right.
And so at that point, how radical was the stuff that he was doing in the context of Chess?
Well, Chess was pretty progressive anyway. I mean, Chess had a great rhythm section. Chess had those guys who were electrifying the blues.
Mm-hmm.
Chuck Berry uses them to do his music. I mean, he does not sound like Muddy Waters. He does not sound like Howlin' Wolf. He's a great storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing that he really brought to rock in its early days. He can tell you a story in like three images and a joke, and it's a great story.
Very concise, yeah. Very
concise. I mean, you know, as a writer, I mean, I think that, you know, I'm always thinking about what fits on the page.
Yeah.
And, you know, he fits in a telegram. Let's listen to No Money Down, where he goes to a Cadillac dealership and basically invents the modern limo.
Pimped his ride.
Well, mister, I want a yellow convertible. Ford Dodeville. With a Continental spare. And a Y-chrome wheel. I want power steering. And power brakes. I want a powerful motor. With a jet off take. I want air conditioning. I want automatic heat. I want a full Murphy bed in my back seat. I want shortwave radio. I want TV and a phone. You know I gotta talk to my baby when I'm riding alone.
So throughout the mid to late 1950s, he's putting out 5-6 singles a year at a pretty, you know, pretty furious. I'd say typical for the day. Maybe it's furious and pace now, but it's maybe pretty typical for the day. A thing that I was struck by in re-listening to a bunch of them was the primacy of the guitar, which seems so, again, it seems so ridiculous to think about that in retrospect. But I hadn't really thought previously about how indebted he was to country music until I heard how he used the guitar, both technique and also how much at the forefront it was. And, you know, we joke about Johnny B. Goode, but like when I was listening to Roll Over Beethoven, which is another semi-hit of his, which is apparently written about him wanting his sister to not practice classical music in the house, but of course ends up being a thing that's basically telling the entire older generation to go kiss off. I was struck about how he's deploying guitar in that song in a way that becomes, in my mind, I mean, I assume they were recorded in order. Somebody's probably going to email in and tell me they weren't, but like assuming they were. So how much were black musicians at that time really, really drawing from country music?
But I think there was overlap. I think they were exposed to it anyway. They were hearing it. There's the whole pipeline from country to Southern soul.
Yes.
That, you know, we're telling stories. We're just telling them with a little more backbeat.
And also didn't, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, it goes both ways. Because didn't Carl Perkins maybe record some Chuck Berry stuff?
Well, yeah. I mean, rockabilly is the reverse formation.
Yes.
Is the country guys getting the blues.
Can we talk a little bit about Chuck Berry vis-a-vis his contemporaries? Because obviously you're thinking about Chuck Berry, you're thinking about Elvis, and you're also thinking about Little Richard.
And Jerry Lee Lewis and Carl Perkins.
Where did Chuck Berry fall in terms of comparison points? Because I think Little Richard had a very, very different sort of influence. And obviously Elvis was taking a lot of these same input points and becoming the biggest original pop icon.
Yeah.
How did they interact with each other at the time?
I assume they ended up on a lot of package tours together.
Yeah.
I don't know if they were talking. I mean, you know, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the Beach Boys had this trialogue going on. Mm-hmm. I don't know that Chuck Berry was thinking about Elvis. My feeling is, and I could be wrong, was that he was just doing his thing. But they ended up with an American music that was polyracial. They were drawing from the same roots and putting individual styles on it. Let it be said, though, that Chuck Berry was right in these things, and Elvis Presley was not. I mean, Chuck Berry was the mastermind. Elvis Presley was the voice and the costumes and the moves, but Chuck Berry was the grandmaster.
To what degree do you think race held Chuck Berry back from being bigger than he was? And he was
big. A huge degree.
Right.
A huge degree, because in 1959, he gets arrested for transporting a minor across state lines, and he goes to jail. The other rock and roll pioneers, they shipped Elvis Presley off to the Army. Jerry Lee Lewis had the scandal from marrying his cousin. Mm-hmm. All of those guys faced a lot of opposition. But jail's pretty much the worst.
Yeah, and Chuck Berry goes away for 18 months or 20 months, and by the time he comes out,
some of the spark is gone.
Yeah, and also the music has changed a little bit, because he comes out in, what, 63 or 64? It's not the same as it is in the late 50s.
Yeah, things move pretty fast.
Yeah, people were moving at a rapid clip.
But meanwhile, while he's in jail, the Beatles are recording Roll Over Beethoven. The Stones are recording every Chuck Berry song they can get their hands
Literally picking over his catalog.
Yeah, and so he's losing ground to himself.
Let's talk about the British invasion, because obviously to see your stuff picked over clean has got to be frustrating.
It's also the persistent story of pop is the white facing of black music.
Right.
You know, it went further with the Beatles than it did with Chuck Berry.
And the Stones.
And the Stones.
Yes. So let's talk a little bit about why at that point, and this is a bigger question, of course, why were British bands better at that, more effective at that than American bands? Their careers, superstar careers, built off of that kind of theft. Was that because there was sort of a richer legacy in the UK of American blues, or what exactly was it?
Well, I actually think the British, they're the late adopters.
Yeah. They're
the students. The Americans are the innovators, and the British are the late adopters. They latch onto it after it's been innovated, and they bring it back at the time when it's ready for the mass market. They were also, you know, cute pop pinups. You know, Chuck Berry.
I can relate.
and Chuck Berry was already a grown up. So, you know, you have the fresh faced, smiling, matching suited Beatles singing Roll Over Beethoven, and I'm sure a good proportion of baby boomers thought, oh, they wrote a great song.
We may not know much about what Chuck Berry's interactions with them were like in real time, since a lot of the original taking was happening when he was in jail. But what we do know is that there is this document of what his relationship with his legions of devoted followers / pilferers was like, which is a documentary that is made on the occasion of his 60th birthday. So that is 1987, I think, or 86 or 87.
86.
And it is called Chuck Berry, Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll. The backstory of it is interesting. It begins as kind of a two-part tribute concert organized by Keith Richards, bringing in a bunch of super, super famous people to pay honor to basically the guy who, without whom, none of them would have careers.
Right.
And it ends up being half that and half Chuck Berry fighting with people, kind of.
They wouldn't make a documentary like that now, you know? They would leave all that on the cutting room floor.
Or, alternately, the opposite. It would only be about that. Like, we're in a reality TV era. So,
true.
Like, in a weird way, it's actually very modern. The director's Taylor Hackford, right? And,
right?
And from what I read, he basically sort of was like, this is what I have. I'm going to work with this.
I'm rolling film.
Yes.
Chuck Berry basically told Keith Richard, who has studied him and paid homage to him and genuflected at his feet, told Keith Richard he was playing the lick wrong. And, you know, take that.
Yeah, I mean, he probably was.
But let's talk a little about some of his, I mean, some of the songs where his messages were sort of wily and veiled. I'm thinking about Brown Eyed Handsome Man, which is an amazing song.
Beautiful daughter couldn't make up her mind between a doctor and a lawyer man. Her mother told her, darling, go out and find yourself a brown-eyed handsome man. Just like your daddy, he's a brown-eyed handsome man. Marlo Venus was a beautiful lass. She had the world in the palm of her hand. She lost both her arms in a wrestling match to meet a brown-eyed handsome man. She fought and won herself a brown-eyed handsome man. 2-3 the count, with nobody on, he hit a high fly into the stand. Round the third, he was headed for home. It was a brown-eyed handsome man that won the game. It was a brown-eyed handsome man.
So that's Brown-Eyed Handsome Man.
Something different happens in every verse.
Yeah.
And it goes from women being drawn to the brown-eyed handsome man to, at the end, the brown-eyed handsome man wins the baseball game. It's the brown-eyed handsome man is probably a brown-skinned handsome man, but that's not something you could put on the radio. But the pride is there, the wit is there, the concision is there, and it sounds like a good time. It sounds like a rumba.
And if I'm not mistaken, there's also, maybe it's in the first verse of that song, talking about the judge's wife says that you got to let this guy out. So there is this also like specter of miscegenation.
Yeah.
Because if it's a judge, presumably it's a white judge, and it's a white judge, presumably a white woman. Like, there is this specter that's underlying all of that of kind of like cross-racial pollination, which is, that's how that stuff had to work in the 50s and 60s.
But to even get that far with it, to even make it that much of a hit at the time, was pretty spectacularly strategic.
Was there coding that he couldn't get away with? Or was it only overt stuff that you think that he couldn't get away with? Do you think that because obviously he was being policed in both literal senses and metaphorical
there's
senses,
there's
right?
A lot of police in his songs. I mean, they're chasing him and you can't catch me.
Yeah.
There's Tulane, which is another great story song in which Tulane's a girl. She's got a boyfriend. They have a novelty shop. They're selling the good stuff in the back. Mm-hmm. The police bust them. Tulane gets away on foot, and the singer is basically telling her how to establish an alibi, get away, and then bail him out of this rotten, funky jail. All in, you know, bouncing along.
Go by your father's house, tell him business is slow, and see if he will loan us up, and soon you hit the door. Put the cat out in the hall and ruffle up the room. Go by Dr. Keller's, tell him you swallowed some perfume. Tell him we need him quick, because he may have to testify that you've been sick all day, and that's a perfect alibi. Go ahead on, Tulane.
The storytelling in this is just fantastic. But the specter of law enforcement as, you know, going to grind you down is also very much in there. Tulane came out in 1970 after he came out of jail. Mm-hmm. I don't know when he wrote it. The information tended to be sketchy in those days.
Yeah, right. Chuck Berry had not put out an original album since the mid-70s or late 70s. I can't think of
it. Yeah, something like 25 years.
Yeah. But late last year, there was an announcement that he's putting out or was going to put out and maybe still will.
In June.
In June, a new album called Chuck. What do we know about that record?
Well, I've heard what they sent out as an advance before he died, and the songs aren't the greatest, but the spirit is. He's still playing guitar well. He's still singing well, which leads me to wonder when it was exactly recorded.
Sure, he had 25 years.
Yeah, but there's a song on it called "Lady Be Good" in which Johnny B. Goode's wife gets some shout outs. It's I'm happy it's there. It's not up there with the Great 28, but it's just amazing that it's there at all.
Yeah, the Great 28, and you know, here's a guy who I don't want to say his best work ends up as an anthology, because it's like, that's, I don't mean to be dismissive in that way.
Well, it was the singles era.
It was the singles era. And so if you actually want to sit and understand Chuck Berry in his prime, there is actually an excellent anthology that you can go. I think it's on Spotify, too. I think it's widely available. It's called The Great 28, and it'll take you everywhere you need to go. And I think maybe avoids my dingling. I'm not.
No, it's there, I think.
Damn.
Yeah, I think it's there. Yeah, that's the sad thing about Chuck Berry. His biggest hit was a stupid novelty song he didn't write.
Which we are not going to play for you.
Yes.
We will not
do that. We're going to spare you this. I mean, I'm glad he made the money, though. I got to say, I'm glad he made the money. I'm glad he was back on. I'm glad his name was spoken on AM radio.
Right. What should we close out with?
I think we should do Nate Eadkin. It's one of his great story songs. And he's chasing this girl every way he can think of, and I hope he got her in the end.
As I got on a city bus and found a vacant seat, I thought I saw my future bride walking up the street. I shouted to the driver, "Hey, conductor, you must slow down. I think I see her. Please let me off the bus." Nadine, honey, is that you? Oh, Nadine.
Thank you for listening to the New York Times podcast. Thank you to my guest, Chief Pop Music Critic John Pareles.
Always great.
Appreciate speaking with you about the legacy of Chuck Berry. You can read both JP's obituary and my appraisal of Chuck Berry at nytimes.com/music. You can subscribe to the podcast, which I would highly, highly suggest that you do, because it's fire. Subscribe to it at iTunes, Google Play, anywhere else that you get your audio content. Our producer is Pedro Rosado. We will be back next week.
And thanks, Chuck Berry, for the rock and roll.
True.